It is a pleasure and a privilege to be in this institution where, as Faisal said, I have been a senior associate member and where I have spent some very happy times. So I'm delighted to be back. And I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about my research among Britain's Anglo-Indians and to tell you about my forthcoming book on the community, in which I emphasize the manner in which they have attained near invisibility through the process of assimilation. Now, in order to illustrate what I mean by invisibility, it might be best to recount for you an incident that occurred just a few weeks ago. I had relocated from my home in London in the East End to Ealing on the West End, a diverse pocket of contemporary British cosmopolitanism. And as I approached the tube station ticket counter to buy my travel card for the month, I noticed that the name tag on the gentleman who was serving me was Clayton. Within a few minutes of conversation with him, I realized that he and I had a similar accent, what I call a very middle-class, convent-educated Bombay accent. And so I turned to him and I observed him more closely, and I realized he was paler than most Indians and that he also had light eyes. And if I take my glasses off, you'll notice my light eyes. So there was something that we had in common. And so before I knew it, I put two and two together and I made a dozen. And I turned to him and I said, "Excuse me, but are you by any chance an Anglo-Indian?" And he was stunned. He looked at me and then he broke out into this great big smile and he said, "I have been in this country for 35 years. And this is the first time anyone has correctly identified me as an Anglo-Indian. Well done," he said. So as you would say in this country, I was quite chuffed when I heard that. And it was the start of a lovely exchange when I had a chance to talk to him about my ethnographic research based in the UK. So what exactly has been the nature of my scholarly work in the UK over the last almost 10 years now? Well, to sum it up, I think it would be first necessary to define Anglo-Indians. According to the 1949 Constitution of India, which states that Anglo-Indian is a person whose father or any other of whose male progenitor in the male line is or was of European descent, but who is domiciled within the territories of India and is or was born within such territories to parents habitually resident therein and not established there for temporary purposes only. So two things are important. The paternity needs to be European, and the person needs to have been born within what was then the Indian colony. So if you have a similar situation with the offspring born in England, it wouldn't be considered Anglo-Indian. If you had a similar situation with the mother being European and the father Indian, it wouldn't be considered Anglo-Indian, according to the very strict definition in the British Constitution. In his book, The Anglo-Indians, A 500-Year History, S. Muthiah calls such children of colonialism Euro-Indians, because they had paternal ties with Portuguese, French, and Dutch colonials in India prior to the arrival of the British, when they were known variously as Luso-Portuguese, Lusitanians, Ferengis, and Eurasians. The subsequent arrival of the British created more mixed racial progeny on the Indian subcontinent and led eventually to the use of the term Anglo-Indian to refer to them. The Anglo part of this nomenclature eventually alluded not to Anglo-Saxon blood ties, but to the fact that English became the mother tongue of all Euro-Asians, regardless of the nationality of their paternal forebears. The India-based Anglo-Indian novelist I. Allan Seeley writes, and I quote from him, it's up there, "No matter what your racial makeup, if you grew up speaking English at home, dressing in a certain way, eating a certain sort of food, you grew up Anglo-Indian. After all, the Anglo in Anglo-Indian referred not to an English ancestry, but to the language you called your own. which is why you might have had a French or a Dutch male ancestor contributing to your genes and disclosed in your surname, but you still ended up as part of this Anglophone cultural group. These cultural practices and not your blood made you what you are. Now, this is Seeley writing an essay in a book that I have only recently edited. Thus, although in South India, people of mixed blood have descended largely from the Portuguese male line and carry Portuguese last names, their mother tongue is English and they are termed Anglo-Indians. So now that we know exactly among which community I narrowed down my research, let me define what I mean by first wave Anglo-Indians. By the time the community of mixed racial descendants in India encountered the first quarter of the 20th century, regardless of the national, the original nationality of their European forefathers, they enjoyed the protection of the British Raj. This included privileges of guaranteed employment in British-run institutions in India, such as the railway network, the post and telegraph system, customs and excise, in a tacit partnership that ensured their cooperation in effecting smooth operation of colonial interests on the subcontinent. In the Anglo-Indian vision, Glory Jean Moore writes, and I quote, "They had been reared to rule an empire as silent partners. Their emotional life bore witness to the success of colonizing centuries. They were loyal to the Raj. They did not question it. They accepted the hierarchy and their place within it." Such mutually beneficial arrangements between colonizer and colonized had ensured a comfortable, if modest, living for the community, at least through the late Victorian and Edwardian periods and up to independence in 1947. But it soon became common knowledge that after independence, the indigenous Indian government would adopt a procedure for the gradual abolition of preferential job allocation to allow the Anglo-Indians to make an adjustment to the new order. In 10 years, at 10% reduction per year, the reservation quota for Anglo-Indians would be phased out, according to Blair Williams. Insecure about their prospects after the Raj, the community began to question the wisdom of continued domicile in India and turned its thoughts towards emigration to Great Britain. At precisely the same time, as if in answer to their concerns, the British Nationality Act of 1948 expanded to permit Anglo-Indians legal settlement rights in the UK if they were able to document the British origins of a paternal ancestor, according to Alison Blunt. While the provisions of the British Nationality Act 1948 were a boon to some, they were a hindrance to others, as members of the community scrambled about to produce acceptable documentation proving British paternity. Blunt makes reference to, I quote, 400 pieces of research completed by the Society of Genealogists in London on behalf of Anglo-Indians, unquote. By 1970, Frank Anthony, late president of the All India Anglo-Indian Association, estimated that 50,000 Anglo-Indians had migrated, half of whom had resettled in Britain. These settlers became what I term, for the purpose of my study, Britain's first wave Anglo-Indians. Blunt also quotes Neil O'Brien, another former president of the All India Anglo-Indian Association, who reflected that the first euphoria of independence for some was for others the shock of a new era. Emigration began in great numbers. It was, in fact, an exodus. That Anglo-Indian exodus to the UK that began in 1948 continued intermittently until 1962, when the Commonwealth Immigrants Act was passed, restricting further entry into the UK. By this time, Australia had lifted its prevailing whites-only immigration policy so that the tide turned elsewhere and the number of Anglo-Indians entering Britain from India fell dramatically. For the purpose of my study, those Anglo-Indians who left India as immigrants to the UK in the years between 1947 and 1962 are referred to as First Wave. Since the early 1960s, that is after the passing of the Commonwealth Immigrants Act of 1962, settlement or resettlement in Britain has been severely curtailed, and employment opportunities for new prospective settlers, regardless of their paternity, has been affected. Anglo-Indian immigration to Great Britain has continued since then only very sporadically. Now, what was my methodology for carrying out this research? My forthcoming book represents the outcome of a year spent in the UK, followed by several consecutive summers, between 2008 and last year, conducting ethnographic field research. To the best of my knowledge, no attempt had been made to use the format of the personal interview with individual members professing such hybridity to document and analyze the community collectively with special reference to the experiences they encountered during the process of migration and integration. I used tried and tested techniques of investigative journalism, such as the personal interview and the group interview, to bring an authentic immediacy to the unique lifestyle and culture of this community, seen in comparison with that of their South Asian patriots here in the UK. Indeed, my study remained focused on details of Anglo-Indian lived experience, as seen through the personal memories of elderly interviewees. Since I was fortunate enough to live amongst the community for extended periods of time, I incorporated anthropology's hallmark fieldwork method of participant observation into my study. As a qualitative approach, particularly suited to gaining new theoretical insights, the argument in this inquiry was made by linking 75 case studies. Sources of oral evidence converge on the same set of issues, struggles and challenges, as they gave way to triumphs and successes. Each case has involved close, contextually sensitive analysis of this phenomenon. Cases that comprise this study addressed a distinctly similar demographic component of India's departing population in the middle of the 20th century. Young, Christian, English-speaking, educated males and females of mixed racial descent. Comparisons between prevailing conditions in the two nations, that is sender versus host, were considered with reference to ultimate impact on immigration and integration. Now, what was the rationale for my inquiry? My study was inspired by fieldwork carried out amidst the Anglo-Indian community in Madras, now Chennai, in India, by Lionel Kaplan. Findings subsequently published in 2001 in his book, Children of Colonialism, Anglo-Indians in a Post-Colonial World. Kaplan's work had focused expertly on members of the community who had stayed on in India after independence. The time was ripe, I realized, to present a similarly comprehensive portrait of the community in the UK. Already in the twilight of their lives, remaining first wave Anglo-Indian immigrants who arrived here in their late teens or early 20s are now in their 80s and 90s, if they are still living. They will be the last to provide reports of their immigrant journeys towards integration or to permit documentation of them. Through my work, I give voice to a generation of immigrants whose oral history might well be lost with their demise. Kathleen M. Woodward is accurate in her assessment that in recent times, statistical understandings of population have come to frame and often usurp the cultural that exists alongside. Indeed, while sociologists and anthropologists have used theoretical analyses to grapple with the paradoxes of South Asian diasporic communities in Britain, the key difference that defines my study is its emphasis on oral history, in which culture and cultural metamorphosis are placed at the forefront. I traced the ways in which Anglo-Indian mass migration to Britain occurred in the post-World War II era, when decolonization was accompanied by dismal cultural relations between settler and host communities. The gradual assimilation of the community occurred over half a century during decades of successful global civil rights movements and amended immigration laws, just as civil wars and impoverishment in third world countries caused an influx of formerly colonized settlers into Western nations. Thus, while Anglo-Indian entrants to the UK had been confronted with interracial conflicts when their brown Anglo-Indianness clashed with white Britishness, later attempts at assimilation became entwined with wider issues of amalgamation, such as interreligious marriages and community entrepreneurship. In more recent years, Anglo-Indian cultural differences in the UK have become submerged by globalization and modernity amidst the burgeoning multiracial diversity of Great Britain. Now, what were the objectives of my inquiry? My chief objective in launching this study was to shed light on an aged, ignored, virtually unknown South Asian Christian minority whose descendants are fast losing their distinctive bicultural identity in the global melange that is modern-day Britain. In recognizing the need to inform scholars of post-colonial mixed-race people, inquirers into the politics of social and racial integration, and critics of contemporary creative production that focuses on the progeny of colonialism, my inquiry attempted to address issues that have remained conspicuous by their absence. I tried to provide an in-depth ethnographic profile from information gleaned through sustained qualitative observation experience of the immigrant Anglo-Indian community in Great Britain that I identified, described, and analyzed as a distinctly South Asian subculture. My work attempted to answer questions posed at academic conferences, as well as at less formal international reunions of the community around the world, such as, whatever happened to Anglo-Indians who emigrated to the UK immediately after India's independence? The answer. Speaking very generally, they believe that they have fared well financially, and that they are far better off than their counterparts in India who chose not to migrate. Most of them joined the transportation networks in the UK or took on government employment as the thought of retirement benefits and pensions were attractive to them. The majority bought and owned their own homes, mainly in the suburbs around the periphery of London. They were rarely in debt, for they lived frugally and within their means. They socialized initially exclusively with other Anglo-Indians, but in recent years have ventured beyond their own community to embrace friendships with white Britons and other South Asians. However, they cannot deny that despite over half a century of living in the UK, they are unidentifiable as a distinct ethnic minority. They have, in fact, become invisible. Now, how have they fared in socio-economic terms in comparison with other South Asian immigrants who followed? They do not have the business acumen of the Gujaratis or the Sindhis, and therefore do not come anywhere close in terms of financial prosperity with their other South Asian compatriots. However, their fluency in English and their general westernization have kept them better off than more recent immigrants from, say, Bangladesh, who are the worst off South Asian community in financial terms in this country. The Anglo-Indians are proud of simple facts, that they have never had to resort to council housing, that they have never resorted to criminal activity, that they have never lived on the dole. Their children, likewise, have not done as well as other second generation South Asians born in the UK, and their parents are uniformly disappointed that they have not taken advantage of the educational benefits that were available to them here. Overall, the community is far from academic, seems to shun professional enterprise, and seems to have settled into jobs that do not require advanced educational qualifications or credentials. Consequently, while they are not poor, they cannot boast the monetary assets of other South Asian communities in Britain. Now, what sorts of challenges did they encounter through the process of integration? And were these different from the ones faced by their South Asian counterparts? Mostly, as I have said above, they suffered from misidentification. Few Britons knew what Anglo-Indians were, or were willing to understand their complex background and their ancestral heritage. Since they did not look, speak, or behave in the way immigrants usually did, their presence baffled their neighbors. In the early days, they were required to repeatedly explain their origins to their British counterparts and then hope that overt Westernization, as evidenced in their fluent English, their Western garb, their Christian faith, and forms of religious practice, would bring them social acceptance. In other words, they hoped to become and be accepted as good immigrants. We've all heard about the good immigrants, bad immigrants debate that is raging right now. They wanted to see themselves as good immigrants, and they hoped these aspects would contribute to it. Now, to what extent can theoretical concepts of migration and resettlement produced by sociologists over the last half century be applied to Anglo-Indian immigrants? The time limitations of the short presentation, unfortunately, do not make it possible for me to delineate in sufficient detail the theoretical base that I employ to trace Anglo-Indian integration into the UK. Suffice it to say that the theoretical framework offered by urban American sociologist Robert E. Park and his associate Ernest W. Burgess, referred to in my study as the Park-Burgess cycle, was employed. In Introduction to the Science of Sociology, Park Burgess delineated four stages of race relations through which a subordinate community passed upon integration into a dominant one: competition, conflict, accommodation, and assimilation. My thesis reiterates Park Burgess' belief that when the migrating community finally takes on the character of inherent parts of the prevailing social order, assimilation has been achieved. My examination of these stages and the manner in which Anglo-Indians adjusted and accommodated themselves to the demands of their new host community reveals that in most respects, they follow the Park-Burgess cycle quite accurately. Hence, their complex racial makeup neither paved the way towards easier integration for them, nor for that matter, did it make it more challenging or more complex. In many ways, their path to assimilation has been very similar to all other South Asians in this country. Does migration theory accurately reflect the roots of migration adopted and pursued by the UK's Anglo-Indians? The short answer is yes. They did go through different stages in the process of assimilation, and while there were always individual stories that differ from the norm, it would be fair to say that their feeling of complete comfort with their host nation and its people was acquired gradually and through hesitant steps. Now, why are Anglo-Indians invisible in Britain? We come now to the very crux of my presentation. As far as their virtual invisibility goes, four factors ostensibly account for their disappearance into the British mainstream. Number one, they carry the European surnames of their forefathers and are baptized with Christian first names. Next, they are 100% Christian by religious affiliation, mostly Roman Catholic, although there exists a sizable Protestant segment. Third, their mother tongue is English. Fourth, they have always been a highly westernized people, and therefore they don Western garb. They cannot be identified as having originated from South India by their saris or their bindis because they do not wear them. One does not hear markedly vernacular affected Indian accents in their voices. Since English has always been their mother tongue, their speech is not impacted by regional mother tongue interference. They have never entered into public controversy based on religious tenets or cultural dogma. For example, while the Sikhs in the UK protested the use of helmets while riding two-wheelers, or the ban on their carrying of kirpans, which is daggers, in public places, while Hindus in the US state of New Jersey were easily recognized and targeted by the Dot Busters as a result of their bindis. And while South Asia's Muslims have run into issues involving the use of hijabs or burqas, or upon their insistence on certain dietary measures such as halal, or in the case of Jews, kosher, in the case of Anglo-Indian culture, being that it is so attuned to that of mainstream Britain, it has steered the community clear of such conflicts. So nothing seems to have really brought the spotlight onto them. Thus, but for their skin color, which varies enormously from Caucasian white to ebony black, based on my own observation of the numerous Anglo-Indian interviewees that I encountered in the UK, they have merged almost seamlessly into British communities and sport no distinctive markers of ethnic identity in Britain. 6 decades after their relocation and resettlement, little is known about Britain's Anglo-Indians. Their presence appears to be too minuscule to have warranted public attention. Largely indistinguishable, they remain an obscure entity more than half a century after they staked their place in the British multiracial mosaic. Yet, members of the community in Great Britain today contest the notion that they have been marginalized because their number is negligible and their lifestyle insufficiently distinct. On the contrary, Anglo-Indian leaders of the community in Britain today argue that they are a cultural nonentity in a country that became rapidly pluralized in the last quarter century because of deliberate attempts made by the community to merge as quietly and completely as possible into the British mainstream in order to achieve 2 goals. A total social acceptance by their white British counterparts, and the privilege of not being othered, of not being perceived as oriental or exotic or in any way different. To understand the complicated invisibility of the situation in which the UK's Anglo-Indians find themselves, it is necessary to turn to the immediate post-independence period, when early entrants had limited choices in how to settle in their host nations. Indeed, immigration to any British Commonwealth nation would carry similar challenges associated with facing the newly arisen crisis of identification and dislocation. But in Great Britain, they experienced what Mina Alexander calls the shock of arrival, all the more acutely as they had wrongly assumed an open-armed welcome based on their paternity and the provisions of the British Nationality Act that imposed upon them legal immigrant status. Thus, they were both shocked and profoundly discouraged by the overt racism they experienced in the early decades of cultural realignment. It must be noted that first wave Anglo-Indians in the UK were certainly not the first settlers to face rejection upon relocation. Blunt states that migration and resettlement from India to Britain took place before as well as after formal decolonization. She quotes Shompa Lahiri, who states that a range of research challenges the myth that the Asian presence in Britain and Europe is largely a post-war phenomenon. The bulk of scholars who trace South Asian presence in Great Britain prior to independence, such as Rosina Visram, Michael Fisher, and Shompa Lahiri, make reference to the ridicule and the insults to which early South Asians were routinely subjected in the UK, whether they were short-term visitors or settlers, not to mention overt racism when it came time to find employment in professional fields such as medicine or the law. First wave Anglo-Indians arriving in post-World War II Britain's hostile racialized environment were unprepared for the cold reception they encountered. Indeed, in a climate in which all persons of colour in the UK, regardless of their national origin, were ostracised, as seen repeatedly in the novels of Andrea Levy, Hanif Qureshi, or Glenn Duncan, that trace the experiences of early coloured immigrants in the UK from varied backgrounds, Anglo-Indians who had arrived in the UK between 1948 and 1962 faced rejection and resentment. But unlike early Indians who had arrived in the UK in minor sporadic flows before independence, the significant size of the first wave Anglo-Indian influx into Britain in the first two post-colonial decades marked them out as targets for racial barbs. And so we come to their paradoxes of identity. Faced with confusing dilemmas of identification, they were forced to make one of two difficult choices, both of which led to undesired and unpredicted results. If they chose to identify as cultural hybrids and maintain a community associated with that hybridity, they were ghettoized with other South Asians in the UK, such as Pakistanis or Bangladeshi Muslims or Indian Sikhs or Hindus, that is, those without European blood ties, and mistaken for them, mainly in London suburbia where they had congregated. Yet, on the other hand, if they chose deliberate isolation from the rest of the South Asian community, including their own Anglo-Indian network, they were no longer identified as South Asian and therefore gradually no longer counted within the South Asian diaspora. Anglo-Indian paradoxes of identity were further exacerbated in the last quarter of the 20th century. In the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, as Britain's African and Caribbean colonies became independent, the UK saw yet another influx of immigrants fleeing newly repressive dictators, such as General Idi Amin, who drove all Asians out of Uganda. Thus, newer South Asian communities, such as Gujarati Hindus from Uganda or Goan Christians from Kenya and Tanzania, arrived as settlers in Britain, as they lacked faith in indigenous African post-colonial governments. The flow into the UK of diverse immigrants of South Asian origin during this period, that is, after the first wave Anglo-Indian flows from India had dried up and been diverted towards Australia, worsened issues of misrecognition and added to the lack of understanding of the peculiar cultural and historical predicaments of the Anglo-Indians as a pioneering first-wave immigrant group of mixed racial descent. In being misidentified with more recent South Asian immigrants who shared their physical characteristics, such as a wheaten skin color and a fondness for Indian curries, greater cultural confusion resulted, both their own and in terms of the broader British social body within which they desired integration. Over the decades, therefore, Anglo-Indians in Britain, desirous of maintaining their cultural uniqueness and seeking not to be identified with their Indian compatriots, formed cultural and social associations aimed at the creation and maintenance of an ethnic subculture that I term British Anglo-Indianness. By shunning social intercourse within the broader South Asian diaspora and deliberately congregating with other Anglo-Indians through the formation of Anglo-Indian associations and ex-student organizations pertaining to their Anglo-Indian schools in India, they believe that they have established a distinct sense of community in the UK, which in turn has aided their sense of belonging in their host nation. The majority of the Anglo-Indians I interviewed, however, claimed that native Britons do not identify them as a separate entity of Indian origin. And indeed, the establishment of an Anglo-Indian subculture in this country, that is British Anglo-Indianness, has in turn led to their being expelled from the broader South Asian diaspora, because South Asians without mixed bloodlines do not seem to consider Anglo-Indians as South Asians. So, in other words, they're neither here nor there. Where, on the other hand, large numbers of the first wave Anglo-Indians chose not to congregate with other South Asians, or even indeed with other Anglo-Indians in the UK, they met with even more unexpected outcomes. They attempted immediate integration with mainstream British society by choosing to live in isolated fashion away from South Asian pockets of habitation. They also attempted to avoid racial discrimination by denying their Indian roots or their maternal connections and by making false claims of national origin, stating, for instance, that they were Spanish or Maltese or Greek, attempting what is termed as passing for something that they were not. Paler members of the community found such declarations easy to carry through, as their Caucasian complexions permitted them to be mistaken for the British mainstream, within which they blended with less effort. Denial of their origins has led to even greater paradoxes of belonging, as I have previously argued in an essay in the International Journal of Anglo-Indian Studies, and I'll be happy to give you that link if you need it. Gradually, the choosing of this option has led to the secession of their inclusion within the South Asian diaspora, a matter that was further assisted by their European surnames, Christian religious affiliation, English mother tongue, and Western garb. And it has further led to their unbelonging among their own South Asian compatriots, who no longer even perceive them as Indian. While this outcome might have appealed and continues to appear attractive to some, many members of the community find that they have lost their distinctiveness as a people of particular cultural heritage, as well as the privilege of inclusion within the South Asian diaspora. Thus, in mapping out their process of resettlement in the UK, it is possible to identify two tropes: creation and establishment of an ethnic subculture by deliberate congregation with other Anglo-Indians, and B, rejection of every aspect of their Indianness by remaining socially and culturally isolated from other Anglo-Indians and other South Asians in order to assimilate speedily into the British society. In both cases, regardless of which route they chose to make integration possible, in their determination not to be singled out as other in the UK, Anglo-Indians have been relegated to the cultural periphery. On the one hand, in having created a distinctly new hybrid subculture, i.e. British Anglo-Indianness, distinct from that of immigrant Hindu, Sikh or Muslim immigrants from the Indian subcontinent in Britain, this Christian minority has ceased to be counted within the South Asian diaspora. On the other hand, in denying their Indianness, they have lost essentially Indian elements of their Anglo-Indianness, such as their exclusive preference for Indian cuisine, while not becoming completely British. For instance, they have never embraced British pub culture. They have never adopted the British leisure pursuit of gambling at the bookmakers or of sunbathing at the seaside resorts. The labyrinth of cultures, Indian, Anglo-Indian, and then Anglo-Saxon, through which they have negotiated their way from first entry as young settlers to septuagenarian grandparents and octogenarian great-grandparents in the UK today, makes a fascinating study. After more than 60 years since the first wave of mass migration occurred, Anglo-Indians have become almost fully integrated into British society. However, adjustment and integration were long and hard in coming, and assimilation was achieved at a considerable price, that of effacement of cultural and maternal markers of identity. While the quest for societal acceptance has succeeded in effacing difference, it has somewhat unexpectedly created yet another cultural hybrid, that of the British Anglo-Indian, that is different and distinct, for instance, from the Australian Anglo-Indian or the Canadian Anglo-Indian in the global diaspora of people of mixed racial descent. Ironically, despite having relocated to Great Britain, where they had thought they belonged, they find themselves once again with no stable place of belonging. In straddling two cultures in the UK, that is perceived as neither British nor Indian, they are in the same position in which they had remained in India, that is perceived as neither Indian nor British. Hence, as a community, they have slipped between the cracks, and they do not feature in demographic accounts of any ethnic minority in the UK. Indeed, they have dissolved into the melting pot of British society so completely as to have attained near anonymity. They give truth to the views of Michel Foucault, who argued that racism extinguished those elements of the population deemed threatening and requiring elimination. Willingness on the part of Anglo-Indians to voluntarily eliminate those aspects of their identity and culture that appeared threatening to the host nation, such as carrying strongly aromatic Indian curries to their workplaces in their packed lunch containers, has resulted in erasure of those very aspects of cultural integrity that had made them identifiable as South Asians, such as the presence of kormas or biryanis on their Christmas tables. Today, they serve roasts with all the trimmings. The fact that even the most recent research documenting the South Asian community in the UK, such as studies by Lahiri, Shinder S. Thanli, Michael Fisher, Marjorie Harper, and Stephen Constantine, make no mention of Anglo-Indians, would suggest that they have succeeded in their goals of complete integration. But as a result of their attainment of near invisibility, little scholarly research has singled out this community. It is indeed curious that at a time when cultural studies have been focusing on aspects of coloniality and post-coloniality, too little is still known about Britain's Anglo-Indians. My study has attempted to fill the void by providing an in-depth ethnographic profile of the immigrant Anglo-Indian community in Great Britain from their first entry into this country to the present moment. Attainment of virtual cultural invisibility on the one hand, and the paradoxical development of a new hybrid subcultural identity, British Anglo-Indianness, on the other, is not something the community expected when they migrated. However, by remaining law-abiding, culturally non-threatening, hard-working, productive, honest, and appreciative members of Britain's social fabric, that is, being good immigrants, I offer the argument that they have disappeared as a unique cultural and racial minority. So here's my conclusion. My research set out to present Anglo-Indian ethnography as it has existed in Britain over the past 60 years. A dominant theme of this study turns on a dissonance between the flexible, pluralist, and heterogeneous social and cultural fields in which the community is located, and the recurrent characterization, particularly in fiction and film, of the group and its culture as essentialist, what Kaplan calls fixed, bounded, impermeable, and homogeneous. Clearly, 6 decades after India's independence, and this year we are moving into the 70th year of India's independence, this post-colonial diasporic community continues to articulate such tensions. Sociocultural studies of their hybridized existence exist alongside essentialist rhetoric that have begun to be challenged only recently by what Glenn De Cruz calls the image critics. My enduring aim was to break away from exclusively theoretical discourse and to focus instead on the lessons that might be gleaned from what Richard Werbner calls local knowledge of everyday life in the post-colonial hinterland. In the Anglo-Indian vision, Gloria Jean Moore writes of them, among the older generation were those who were living history themselves. What Moore calls the older generation of Anglo-Indian immigrants are now mainly in the UK, at least the few who have not yet succumbed to memory loss, geriatric illness, or death. It is precisely because I believe that they are receptacles of living history that I tried to track down as many of them as I could. Although, as Moore states, they had remained silent partners of the Raj in India, I was determined that their silence should end, that it should not follow them into their lives as immigrants in Britain. In the articulation of their experiences, they have finally found, I hope, their collective voice. It is my fervent hope that my book shall bring the community out of obscurity in Britain, that it will dispel the stereotypes that have dogged them, and that it will facilitate renewed understanding about a South Asian ethnic minority that has for too long gone unseen and unheard among India's global diaspora. While comparing their near invisibility in the UK with the prominent social position in which Australia's Anglo-Indians find themselves, some British Anglo-Indians are of the opinion that they need to accept some measure of responsibility themselves for their virtual invisibility. Early pioneering determination to blend in with mainstream Britain through an eradication of all culturally identifying markers, including speech accents, plainly succeeded. In the post-war period, pioneering Anglo-Indians did not want to be singled out. They did not desire visibility. In fact, they did everything in their power to erase difference, said an 80-year-old mechanical engineer from Slough. Why would they now wish to be searched out, identified, and counted after all these years? At any rate, even should Anglo-Indians desire and seek visibility in the UK today, it is already much too late. Content to merge into white hegemonic social structures that dominated mid-20th century politics many argue that it is now too late for the UK community to seek a unique cultural position in the immigrant diaspora, even though multiculturalism and globalization have made mixed race and ethnicity fashionable. For several decades, Anglo-Indians were a unique community in the UK, with their part British and part South Asian ancestry spawned in India. They had the field all to themselves, and while they faced a great deal of misunderstanding and misrepresentation, they also reveled in their uniqueness. Today, they are far from distinctive. Globalization has led to communities of mixed racial people everywhere. Anglo-Chinese, Anglo-African, Anglo-Arab, Anglo-Latin American, as well as many Anglo-Europeans, Anglo-Spanish, Anglo-Italian, and so on. Multiculturalism and multiracialism has also made non-British mixed-race people visible minorities in the UK. For example, there are communities filled with people of Chinese West Asian ancestry or Polish Indian ancestry. However, as a community, Britain's Anglo-Indians can still claim that they were probably the first mixed-race people in the modern world and that they paved the way, in a sense, for other communities of mixed-racial descent that followed in their wake. And who knows, a time might well come in the not-too-distant future when racial and ethnic merging will be so seamless as to erase all distinctiveness and to foster the visibility of just one race, the human race. Since this project involved field research in the UK, I'm very grateful to the Liberal Studies program at New York University, where I have taught South Asian studies for the past 20 years, that provided me with the opportunity and the funding to make my residence in London several times and for prolonged periods over the last 10 years while carrying out research. Needless to say, I'm profoundly grateful to the Anglo-Indian respondents in Britain who invited me into their homes, allowed me to peruse their personal papers, letters, and photograph albums, shared their Anglo-Indian meals with me, told me their stories, and gave me so generously of their time and support. Without their cooperation and their assistance, my scholarship would never have been possible. And finally, of course, I am grateful from the bottom of my heart to all of you for being present at my talk this afternoon. Hopefully, I will have succeeded in convincing you that the scholarly community in Britain needs to take notice of the Anglo-Indians and that they are deserving of our scrutiny. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much.